Choke Points. Brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. The Maple Valley Highway finally reopened to all traffic this morning after an unexpected discovery pushed a weekend culvert project out an extra 3 days. We know that workers found an old wooden road that stopped the excavation work, but Chris went to the state archaeologist who was called out to investigate to get us the full story on that wooden road. Chris, what did you find?
Well, I had a great conversation with the state archaeologist for our region, Jason Cooper. And when his phone rings on the weekend, that usually means that someone on a construction project has found something interesting. And that's exactly what happened last weekend. Workers installing those new culverts under the Maple Valley Highway, just north of Cedar Grove Road, uncovered a long section of wood planks during their excavation. Some thought it was a bridge, others thought it might have been a road, so they called Coop.
Their supervisor gave me a call, said, "Hey, you know, are you available to take a look at this?" And I was like, "Yes, I'll be there as soon as possible."
Cooper did a little quick research, including looking at the King County map vault on the web to see what might have been there before the current Maple Valley Highway was paved.
What I did was I found a road survey map from 1929, which it doesn't show the wood plank, but within the plan, it gave 8,100 lineal feet of wooden plank boards. I was like, that's it right there. You know, that's my smoking gun.
But he couldn't just sit at home. He had to get out there and check it out in person to be sure.
It was my job to evaluate it and make the determination if this was a significant piece of roadway.
And it became clear to him after just about an hour that it was really nothing special.
People thought it was a bridge, but there was no superstructure. There was no trestle buried underneath the fill. It was just a one-tier wooden plank road.
But then comes the next part of this, the investigation. What road? How did it get here? Why is the wood right here? And Cooper was able to determine that it was from the original road built by King County in the 1920s that went from Renton to Maple Valley and eventually out towards Mount Rainier. It became Primary State Highway No. 5 in 1937 when the state took the road over. It wasn't even paved until 1953. And the entire road wasn't made of this wooden structure. It was a combination of packed dirt, gravel, and then this particular section along the Cedar River.
It wasn't just thrown together. It was built as a solution to this particular wet, soggy spot.
Which is kind of funny because workers were there over the weekend dealing with that same wet, soggy spot nearly 100 years later. That section of 169 floods all the time, and last year it was closed for 5 days because of flooding. So even after 100 years, they're still dealing with that wet, soggy road. That's what the culvert project was trying to fix. So after all this, I asked Cooper if he was disappointed.
You always want the Ark of the Covenant, but you know, when you're dealt a plank road, you do what you can.
And Cooper told me that his wife asked him, "Hey, is that road Roman?" That would have been the discovery of the century.
So if they had found the Ark of the Covenant, would they have had to stop work on the highway?
Yes, chances are if the Ark of the Covenant was there, they'd still be doing a lot of digging, and Jason Cooper would be on the cover of every magazine, newspaper, TV right now. Mm-hmm.
The universe would have folded in on itself by now, right?
But it's possible. I mean, it depends on if he opened it. But instead, you know, instead of being a number one news topic around the world, Jason just got to talk to me, which I know is a close second. But yeah, it was fabulous. I could have talked to Jason all day. I love talking about stuff like this. I'm kind of a kinship with archaeologists and people like Felix and historians and stuff. And so I thought people should know exactly why that road was closed for a couple extra days and give you the full scoop.
Well, you
know, they're great pictures, by the way, at mynorthwest.com.
100 years from now, they're going to discover that culvert and wonder what the heck it was.
Yeah, exactly, especially since the fish will have taken over as our masters.
That's right. To politics we go. This is predicted to be one of the tightest Seattle races this election and one of the most closely watched. I'm not talking about the mayor's race. I'm talking about the debate between City Council Position 9 candidates Nikita Oliver and Sarah Nelson. Converge Media, Rainier Radio, and the South Seattle Emerald teamed up for that debate. And Kaya Radio's Hannah Scott has some of the highlights. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, this, of course, is the seat that's being vacated by current City Council President Lorena Gonzalez. And you've got a couple of different schools of thoughts here. Of course, Nikita Oliver and Sarah Nelson. And as we reported yesterday, the latest polling, Northwest Progressive Institute polling, shows that right now Sarah Nelson has a 4-point lead over Nikita. But Nikita has that power of the late ballots, where they could definitely come from behind. During this debate last night, they first introduced themselves, kind of went over what their goals are, their interests are. And Sarah Nelson is a lifelong Democrat, a mom, plus a lot more, she said.
My husband and I started Fremont Brewing in 2009, and I got to admit I've taken some heat for being the small business owner, you know, in this race, but I think that's important. Because small businesses are the job creators and the nodes of our communities, and they're really struggling right now. And I believe that access to opportunity to build generational wealth is key to transformational change. That means jobs, job training, foreclosure prevention, access to capital, and just help navigating the maze of bureaucracy. And I can do that because I've got that lived experience.
She spoke about her support for the building trades, folks who work in those kind of industries and that kind of thing. For Nikita, they introduced themselves as an attorney, an educator, and an activist on top of that.
I've actively supported families in navigating the housing crisis and homelessness, supported tenants in fighting evictions, and handled employment discrimination cases. I've worked alongside our Office of Civil Rights, our Human Services Department, to ensure that the policies are really meeting the needs of our communities. I am committed to building green, social, affordable housing for our workers and for our lowest income residents, for addressing exclusionary zoning and redlining, and having density that helps us address our climate catastrophe so we can meet our climate goals and transportation for all.
They also noted that they had support from various current city council members, including Tammy Morales, Teresa Mosqueda, as well as the Washington Education Association, as some of their big championing points. Oliver also talked about rent control and how they supported the idea of lobbying for change at the state legislature to make rent control legal in the state.
I don't think rent control is the only answer, though it is one of the answers. I really think that a part of this is going to be utilizing things like the American Rescue Plan dollars, dollars from Jumpstart and other areas of our budget to continue to increase the amount of money that we can give to direct cash assistance to keep people in their homes until we do that very important work of ensuring rent control is an option that we have in our suite of protections for tenants.
And on Sarah Nelson, asked the same question, also had some support for rent control.
I campaigned for the statewide income tax because Seattle is a very regressive tax structure. And that lost, but I think that we need to bring that something like that back. And I would support perhaps a statewide rent control. But I'm concerned about Seattle-only taxes because it creates a patchwork of legislation that is difficult to administer, and it has different impacts on Seattle. And so I think that a better way of helping renters is right now in this crisis, direct cash payments to renters, and that will help them stay in their homes and also help our small landlords.
So, basically, long answers to say that they both support the cash in hand effort, at least for the time being.
That's pretty interesting because I'm hearing more people, both conservative and liberals, saying instead of having elaborate welfare schemes, just hand people cash. It's cheaper.
It's cheap. It is cheaper in the long run, and especially now because there are still those, stimulus dollars, the dollars from the federal government for that effort. One of the interesting things that the next two things I'm going to play you are something interesting they did in this debate where they gave each of the candidates the opportunity to ask their opponent a question. So this is the question and the answer. Both of these have to do with public safety issues. First, Nikita Oliver asking Sarah Nelson about why she thinks some misdemeanors should still be prosecuted.
Sarah, in many ways, you have been a bit of the law and order candidate. You have called for people who you say are living in parks to be removed because they shouldn't be there. You've called for those who have maybe stolen food or clothes because they're trying to survive to be prosecuted for misdemeanors. But you yourself have eco-blocks blocking the street in front of your own brewery, which is a violation of the law. You don't have a permit for it. Why is it that those folks should be prosecuted and your own law violation should be accepted?
I would not phrase myself as a law and order. I'm a public safety person. And when I talk about misdemeanors, those misdemeanors are not small crimes, and especially when they are repeated. over and over again. And this is what I was hearing from Arts Lodge Cinema co-owner, you know, broken into twice. And so when it comes to the Jersey, the eco blocks,
and
every single...
So they only had 30 seconds there to get their answer in. And I want Yeah, they just cut the mic. So they can't elaborate, and there was no elaboration afterwards. But some interesting information there. And I want to make sure we have time for the other one. This is Sarah Nelson asking Nikita the all-important question that I know you ask me all the time. If you want to defund the police and revamp the way we deal with public safety, how are you going to make the public safe?
You have called yourself an abolitionist, and you want to defund the police by 50% next year. That's the budget you're calling for. You have tweeted that want to end violence and poverty. But what are you going to do to keep people safe? What is your plan when people need to call the police if someone's breaking into their home?
2021, we found that 3 years of 911 data from Seattle Police Department said that 49% of calls that come into 911 could receive a non-sworn, non-police officer response. And so based in the data that 50% of calls coming into 911 actually need to receive something like a mental health provider or a de-escalator or a community-based response, it's actually data-based data-driven to move 50% of our public safety budget into those alternative responses.
So not much more different than I've heard in the past, right, in these alternative responses, but nothing very specific as to what that would look like to keep you safe if someone's breaking into your house type
of
thing.
What is the polling show in that race now?
4%, 4 points ahead for Sarah Nelson right now. But again, Nikita has that power where they could easily get some late ballot come from behind situation to win, which is what they did in the August primary. They were behind, and then they came up way ahead after the late ballots were counted.
Iowa Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. A musician turned police officer is sharing his journey from using a violin to a badge to serve his community. CBS's Jan Crawford has the story.
For classical musician Alexander Strawn, the violin is for finding connections. He spent the past decade playing for seniors and the terminally ill, including his grandmother, who had Alzheimer's.
It's almost like she's almost a kid again, playing.
That was something she recognized.
Yeah, something she recognized. It's almost like the fog of Alzheimer's lifted and she's able to see again.
Earlier this year, Strawn found a new way to connect with people, becoming a cop.
In some ways, it is similar to life as a musician because I'm going in the places where I'm not sure what's going to happen, how people are going to react, but it is an adventure.
You've traded in your violin for a weapon, but you're still serving.
Exactly.
Now in uniform, he continues to play, hoping to show a different side of police officers.
I think it shows that I'm human too. I have hobbies, passions outside of police work. And cops are so talented. People don't see that.
Performing with a purpose. Jan Crawford, CBS News, Bowie, Maryland.
Wouldn't it be nice if we knew these little things about everyone who serves us, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
How much more friendly is it to approach somebody you know plays the violin when they're in a position of authority? It's, you know, when you find those commonalities, it just makes connecting with people easier.
Yes, it does. Here's G. Scott. G., as you know, listeners can email us anytime using the inbox at My Northwest, and we love your emails. Although you can stop sending us links to the articles about San Francisco shoplifting problems. We know that the Walgreens is very upset. But I will say it's amazing how brazen the shoplifting has become, not just in San Francisco, but of course here. You see the story about the Lego caper?
Now, this I haven't heard. James told me about it. I haven't heard about it. Somebody stealing Legos?
They arrested some guy at a secondhand store at Pike Place Market for receiving stolen Lego sets, which were being taken by a shoplifter. And apparently they were the shoplifter himself was stealing them out of the Amazon store. And an Amazon employee was walking through the market area and says, wait a second, that was in our store just an hour ago. And so they made an arrest. But... Legos? Come on,
they're
man.
So expensive.
I understand that.
Well, I mean, here's the thing about Legos. First of all, I'm not justifying anybody stealing Legos. Don't steal nothing. That's number one. But number two, Do you know what Legos can do to kids? Keep them occupied for hours.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Hours. And it doesn't matter.
Adults, I mean, too, by the way.
Yeah. Colleen, you look like you'd get occupied by some Legos. 100%.
I love organizing my daughter's Legos into colors and shapes. And it doesn't last very long, but I just sit there organizing while she builds. But they are pricey. The ones they were talking about that were stolen, the Mandalorian and all of that, they can be like $500, $2,000 just for these sets.
What?
Yeah. Why? So they were I think when they first caught on to the shoplifting, the person had stolen what, like $10,000 worth of Legos?
Yeah, right.
And that's right. Not very many boxes.
Well, still, this is probably why Legos are so expensive, just the price of the theft insurance to keep the store in stock. So, you know, you saw the story about the guy in Denny Way, right?
Yes, yes. The guy walks in. He's a 23-year-old young man, walks into a store, grabs $200 worth of merchandise, and just walks out. And the store owner's like, hey, the store owner comes out there and trying to tell him, hey, give me back our stuff. And he kind of sees a gun handle that this perpetrator has a gun on him. So the store owner, instead of walking back into the store, bops the dude over the head. The gun falls out. He takes his gun, right? And then the perpetrator runs, leaves, and they found him. The police found him a few blocks away. But that's kind of dangerous. But these are the things that are starting to happen when these repeat offenders are being able to just steal, come back, and it doesn't matter. Now, I will say this. I'm a little torn because I know out there in Baltimore they had a deal where they stopped prosecuting drug possession and prostitution, right? And that averted. They did a study over in Baltimore. They started in March of 2020 during the pandemic, and everybody thought, oh, this is crazy. And what ended up happening is they averted 440 arrests, and 80% of those, which would have fallen on the black population in Baltimore. Of those that had their charges dropped out there, of the 741 people that got their charges dropped, 6 of those people were rearrested for either violent crimes or robbery. So that's less than 1%. So that's a success story, right? I don't have a problem with the whole drug possession and or maybe prostitution, those things. I have a problem with this whole stealing stuff, because what ends up happening is this. You're just making it easier for big corporations, like people with big stores, franchises, and chains. Those stores can last. But those who gave their money up and probably took a loan out, leveraged their home, a small business owner, they can't survive those things.
Right.
So I think you have to come down. It's hard for me to look away from stealing. And because when you start stealing, it's not like, oh, you know what? I'm going to steal a pack of gum and I'm going to stay consistent with a pack of gum. No, it goes from stealing a pack of gum to a car to breaking into somebody's house. And then you know where it goes from there. It always escalates. I just have a real huge problem with allowing people to just go in and out of people's businesses and being able to steal. One, because it hurts their bottom line. And two, now you're talking about a dangerous situation, because usually what happens is somebody's like, hey, you can't steal that. And then now you're putting that worker or that owner in harm's way.
Right. And you see in the case of the Denny Way shoplifter, after the store manager disarms him, the guy comes back and says, could I have my gun back and I'll return the stuff I took?
I mean,
sounds
on.
Like a fair trade.
I mean, but that's, I don't know. Like, that is kind of the area. Like, I was, this was like 2 years ago in 2019. And I was in a Starbucks downtown, and just some people walked in and they start grabbing stuff out of the little bin and they just got it and walked out. And I looked at the barista that was standing there, and they looked at me, and I said, and they said, yeah, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, like, it sounds like the QFC situation with the alcohol. Remember that? When alcohol sales were allowed at grocery stores, and we started finding all of these thefts at Safeway and QFC and everywhere else. And the worker said, we're told we can't do anything about it because it could harm us or one of our customers if we confront them. And so their solution now at our QFC is to lock up the liquor at the very front by all the check stands. So now you have to buy your sins in front of everyone. It's embarrassing.
But Colleen, you're never there buying anything.
No. I know what I like, so I don't have to browse, but I try to make it a quick transaction. It is a little, I don't know, it's awkward to buy alcohol in front of people because you think, okay, well, if I'm buying for a party and they see me buying four bottles, do they think I have a problem? You know?
Just no. Stand there at the check stand and announce, it's not all for me.
I'm having
a party.
So check this out. It's so crazy that Colleen is bringing up that. I just talked about this the other day. I refuse to buy any alcohol from those situations.
Why?
Because of that. I don't know.
Because of that. Because I'm
a jerk. And I just don't. I get mad. Like, no, it's not supposed to be locked up. And it should not happen. Do I understand?
I shouldn't have to ask for my alcohol. Darn it.
Right? Like, give it to me. Let me go grab it. They don't lock up the wine. How come they don't lock up the wine?
Who wants to get drunk on wine? Ugh.
Oh, I feel attacked.
Well, anyway,
I feel
like
attacked.
It'd be pretty lively, generous
Headache
show,
City.
This morning, starting at 9 on Kyra
Radio. That's how Dave kicks me off. See you later, guys.
Thank you. Construction is underway on a new first-of-its-kind facility at the UW that experts say will be critical to addressing the behavioral health crisis. With the story, here's Kyra Radio's Hannah Scott.
This marks a turning point in our shared commitment to addressing the very serious need for access to mental and behavioral health care across our state.
UW President Anna Marie Cossey at the recent groundbreaking for the new Behavioral Health Teaching Hospital at UW Medical Center Northwest.
Producing more highly skilled professionals dedicated to the kind of care that leads to healthy individuals and to healthy communities, including doctors and psychiatrists, as well as nurses, social workers, and pharmacists.
The legislature passed a bill to create the first-of-its-kind facility back in 2019 and funded it this past session. Former House Speaker Frank Chopp sponsoring the bill, which was personal for him.
My sister was a patient at the psych unit in the UW Medical Center. For decades, she has been seriously challenged by what is called rapid cycling bipolar disorder.
Governor Inslee says it's a vital step in his vision to transform our behavioral health system and critical in addressing one of our other major problems in the state.
Well, mental health treatment is one of the things we need to help people who are living and suffering homelessness right now. It's not the only thing, but it is one thing.
Chopp says the groundbreaking is absolutely reason to celebrate, but with so many chronically homeless people often released back to the streets due to having no home or family to take them in, there's more that needs to be done.
We should expand the state's Apple Health program to authorize doctors and nurse practitioners to write a prescription for a home. As part of that effort, we should allocate $400 million of unallocated federal funds to acquire and build supportive housing for our neighbors who are chronically homeless.
As for the hospital, it will host 150 beds, many for those who are long-term civilly committed, who would normally end up in Western State. At the same time, it will address the massive shortage in medical workers for this field by also being a teaching hospital. It's set to open in late 2023.
Hannah Scott. This is Seattle's Morning News, and joining me now is the basis for the legendary Seattle grunge band, Mudhoney. His name is Guy Madison, and you may not have known that he is also a supervising nurse at Harborview Hospital. How long have you been juggling these two jobs?
Well, I started at Harborview very close to the time I started in Mudhoney. I was been juggling it now for 20 years.
Yeah, but it's never been as intense as it has since COVID, I know. And as a result, you started a podcast called The Emergency Room Diaries. When did you know that this was going to be a particularly stressful time in your nursing career?
Well, it sort of started out slowly. You know, we'd had some scares in the past with infectious diseases and potential outbreaks and pandemics with MERS and SARS. And then also there was the scare of Ebola, you might remember. And this seemed the same when it first, when the news first started to break. It wasn't until March, the end of March, when I got reassigned to a position that was actually helping coordinate the testing and the placement of patients and staff in the hospital, that my work as a nurse really changed a lot.
Yeah. And so how would you, I mean, I'm getting all these horror stories from other states, especially Idaho. What is it like these days at Harborview?
Well, our numbers within UW Medicine match the numbers in Seattle at the moment, where our amount of COVID positive patients is trending down, thankfully. It's still a lot higher than we expected with this final wave of the pandemic. We are not in the same situation that Idaho and Alaska are, and their situation is they've instituted what they call crisis care management strategies. That means that they are completely overwhelmed. They have more cases that they can treat without enough resources, without enough staff, without enough ventilators. We're not in that situation at Harborview or at UW Medicine. We have the staff and the ventilators to deal with the amount of patients we have. It's still a tremendous drain on the hospital, but we are not so seriously affected as, say, Idaho, who has to move its patients out of state, a lot of them to here in Seattle for treatment.
Yeah. I don't know how personal you want to get, but I can only imagine the effect on you. I certainly have heard other nurses talk about what it's like day in and day out to see people die, and many times young people. I assume you've been through that too?
I saw a lot more of that when I was reassigned initially. So to be perfectly clear, at the moment, I'm back in my regular job, and I'm an anesthesia coordinator at the hospital. But I do still see all of my colleagues that work in the ICUs. And yes, it's a tremendous strain to see these people. That's something we've seen a lot of recently is younger people, because they're the people that are not vaccinated that are getting very sick with COVID, being put on the ventilator, being in the hospital for weeks at a time, ending up on extremely invasive treatment like ECMO, which is put simply a heart-lung bypass machine that takes your blood out of your body, puts oxygen into it, and puts it back in your body. This is a last-ditch effort to try and save people, and we're still seeing people on those therapies in the hospital, and some of those people die, and my colleagues who work in the ICUs see it all the time.
So after a day of trying to save lives at Harborview, do you just go home and shred notes on the guitar?
You know, I'm so thankful for my music and my friends that I make music with, Mudhoney. We obviously haven't been doing any shows for quite a long time. All our 2020 engagements were cancelled and pushed to 2021, and once again they were cancelled. But we still get together, and we're working on a new album, so we do get to practice once a week. And yes, as you might be able to see on the Skype call, I'm sitting in my studio with my instruments here around me, and it's a great stress reliever for sure.
Well, I just listened to a 2009 recording of Touch Me, I'm Sick, and I imagine you still play that song.
That's probably the band's most iconic song, most famous song. So, yes, that is included. I can't even think of a single gig that I've ever done with Mudhoney where we haven't played Touch Me, I'm Sick. Love that song.
What has the effect been on Seattle's music scene? The stuff I used to go to at Seattle Center, you know, the opera, the playhouse, the ballet, all had to take a huge hiatus and had some existential moments where you wonder whether they come back at all. What's it been like for your music career?
Similar, but different. Whereas, like you say, the opera and the ballet and the Seattle Symphony are very large productions. And so it's a little bit easier for a band to get together once everyone's vaccinated and practice and pursue music. But in terms of the livelihood side of things and what bands do to make money, which is play shows, they've essentially been shut down for 18 months and are perhaps only slightly coming back now. So it's been devastating in terms of not being able to play shows. You know, musicians love to play in front of other people and get that feedback from the audience. And it's this two-way relationship that's very satisfying for both the people that go to the shows and for the musicians that put them on. It's also been really difficult, I think, for the clubs. We're not sure what the club scene will look like when we come back, who will have survived, what clubs won't be there. Because, you know, even though there was some assistance from the government for small business, a lot of those places couldn't open their doors for well over a year. And that's very difficult to keep people paid in those situations. So it's going to be interesting to see what the landscape looks like when we slowly, you know, move towards getting back to normal.
Yeah. So is this COVID experience, is it going to affect your music at all, or do you keep them separate?
I think COVID's touched everything in life, and it's touched music. You know, we talk about it a lot. It was an interesting process to go through, waiting for us all to get our vaccines. Obviously, I was vaccinated very early as a healthcare worker, and then Mark and Dan got next, and then Steve, who lived in Portland, had a slightly harder time getting on the getting scheduled to get a vaccine. So there was that side of things, and obviously we talk about what our upcoming tour in May 2022 will look like, and you know, there's still a great deal of unknown with COVID. So yeah, there's no way to separate the two. It's had a big impact, and I think that maybe some of the songs on the next record will have some topics related to COVID in them.
Well, good luck, and thank you for your efforts and trying to keep people alive. It's pretty important work.
Dave, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to talk today.
Guy Madison, Mudhoney bass guitarist and supervising nurse at Harborview. Thanks, Guy.
Thank you. You can ring my bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Laura Scott, who's in for Rachel Bell. The opera's coming back. I'm going to the opera this weekend, La Boheme, and looking forward to it. And apparently all over the country this is happening.
Yes, live opera is back. Live theater is coming back. It's super exciting. Dave, I know you are a huge fan of the opera, so this is a long-awaited experience. And I'm a huge opera fan, too, because I actually spontaneously... So I went to liberal arts college, right? So the course offerings were diverse and a little bit odd. And I ended up taking a history of opera class my first year in college. And it was a really immersive class. We saw probably four or five operas. And one of the institutions that we connected with is called Pacific Opera Project, or POP, mm-hmm. based in Los Angeles. And their whole goal is to make opera appealing for younger audiences. Originally, because I took a history of opera course, opera was not high class theater. It was truly, you'd eat dinner in front of it. You'd yell at the stage. And they wanted to try to maybe not recreate the yelling at the stage part of the experience, but the casual mm-hmm. and light, fun part of the experience to bring in younger kind of LA hipster audiences.
Yeah.
So a lot of their events, you can sit at a table and they'll serve you dinner or snacks and they'll give you wine that you can drink throughout the performance. And they host them in interesting places. I went to one in a graveyard. That was a comedy. And then I went to one at a church where it was in two acts. It was Tosca, and we started inside the church, which replicates...
That's where the opera opens. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And then for the second part of the opera, we moved into the church's gardens, and there was an incredibly... Not to give anything away, but a shocking fall from the roof. Yes. Of the church outside that really kind of added to the experience.
Yes, it ends with a very dramatic death. That's a pretty creative staging of Tosca. The thing about opera, and I know a lot of people find it to be tedious and unexplainable, but the whole idea is that it's an acoustic experience. It's an unamplified acoustic experience in an age where all musicals now, everybody's got their head mics and
like small, pop stars.
Yeah, right. And usually pretty small accompaniments and a lot of electronics music, which and most Broadway shows I've seen are very effective. But the whole idea of opera is to try to preserve the pure acoustic nature of the experience. And Seattle Opera does a great job of that in McCall Hall. But of course, that also means the singing style has to be much different, because you have to mm-hmm. get voices that can be heard over sometimes a 70-piece orchestra. And I know that young people typically say, yikes, I can't stand that kind of singing.
Well, I was in choir for years and years and years growing up.
So you know how to sing.
I might be a little bit biased towards singing in general. But I was concerned when I started taking this opera class and when I found out how many operas we were going to go to throughout the course, that it was not going to be interesting because I wouldn't understand what they were saying.
Yeah.
And what immediately surprised me at that very first graveyard performance was that all of the emotion translates through the singing.
When somebody's really in love, you know, when somebody's in danger, you know, when somebody's frightened. But here's the thing about, I mean, you've been to Seattle Opera, right?
I actually haven't.
You haven't?
No.
Okay. Well, they have super titles now. So when an opera is in a different language, there's an English translation that's projected right above the stage. So it's like watching a subtitled movie, except the title's on top of the picture instead of below it.
Well, and we know people can handle subtitled movies because the popularity of Squid Games proves that.
Yes, and sometimes there's almost as much carnage in an opera as there is in Squid Games.
Well, yeah, no, they're wonderful stories and full of drama and emotion, and I highly recommend going and seeing La Boheme.
Yeah, we've missed it. We've been subscribers for, I don't know, as long as we've been here, so like 40 years or so. And I go there, I buy a $4 cookie, I read through the program, we buy the libretto and sort of read ahead to make sure that we get the plot, even though we pretty much know the plot. And then you just immerse yourself in the glory of music performed by a full orchestra and these tremendous voices, especially the basses, whose voices I wish I had. And actually, another good thing is what Seattle Opera does is before the performance, you can go to an hour lecture, which will tell you about the time period and, of course, go over the plot, the story of how it was written, which usually always involves some sort of drama and a mistress or two. So it becomes, you know, it becomes an entire evening experience, which is not only entertaining, but educates you about the history of the time.
Well, I can't wait to hear how this weekend goes. And I'm so glad that you get to go back.
Yep, me too. Laura Scott. Thank you, Laura.
Thanks, Steve.
Yes, and since there'll be a hockey game going on at the same time, we've decided we're going to go early, book a hotel.
Yes.
Stay overnight. Let everybody else fight the traffic and then just ease on home the next day.
I love that idea.
Yeah. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.